2014 has provided a bounty of fascinating Iowa news. This hour, we look back at some of the biggest stories. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, my Iowa Public Radio News colleagues will share important news stories they've been covering this year, including a juvenile sentencing case before the Iowa Supreme Court, construction that damaged a national monument in Iowa, Cedar Rapids' bid for a casino, the difficult legislative birth of the latest farm bill, Iowa's data center boom, and how Iowa commemorated the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. A review of the Iowa news year that was, after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As 2014 draws to a close this hour, we want to cast a glance back on the year that was to survey the Iowa news and trends that my colleagues here at Iowa Public Radio News covered. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll check in with Sarah Bowden. We'll talk about Google, Facebook, and Microsoft building huge data centers here in Iowa. Pat Blank will tell us about a program to track Iowa's native turtles. Amy Mayer with the difficult legislative birth of the latest farm bill. Clay Masters, an investigation into construction that damaged Effigy Mounds National Monument, which contains Native American burial sites. And also John Pemble will be along. He'll talk about how he covered how Iowa commemorated the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. But first, attorneys are keeping an eye on a juvenile sentencing case before the Iowa Supreme Court. Both the U.S. Supreme Court and Iowa Supreme Court have ruled that mandatory life sentences without parole for juvenile offenders are unconstitutional. Now, the Iowa court could clear the way for the first challenger of a juvenile life sentence to be set free. And joining me, Iowa Public Radio correspondent Joyce Russell, who has also been keeping an eye on this case. Hello, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
Let's first have you give us a little more background, please, on the U.S. and Iowa Supreme Court decisions that paved the way for this challenge.
Well, as you explained, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences without parole were unconstitutional. Judges can still do that, but it can't be mandatory. They have to be take into consideration their youth and other things. But they did not make clear whether that should be retroactive to past cases. The Iowa Supreme Court took it up and said, yes, it should be retroactive to past cases. So all of these, there are some 42 people serving life sentences without parole who then became their sentences became subject to reconsideration.
Mm-hmm. And a number of them have been before the parole board, and one by one they have been turned down.
They have been turned down for parole. They've had their sentences, they've gone before judges and had their sentences changed to life in prison with the possibility of parole. That's sort of the first step. But then, as you just said, they've come before the parole board one by one, and the parole board has not granted them parole.
Which brings us to the case before the Iowa Supreme Court, a case involving someone named Yvette Louiselle. Tell us about that.
Well, people in the Ames area will remember that case very well. She was an Iowa State University student, 17 years old, and she stabbed a man to death. And she was under Iowa law, she was sentenced a mandatory life sentence without parole. And she's gone through the same thing that all these other people have gone through that I just described. Her sentence was changed to life with parole. She went before the parole board. The parole board said no. But an attorney, a very experienced attorney, Gordon Allen, has taken an interest in this case. He's working pro bono. But his argument is that since the legislature hasn't come in and clarified what the sentence should be, and since the parole board is acting as though it's still only life sentences, then in effect, Iowa is not complying with court rulings, and that's the argument that he's making, and which is now before the Iowa Supreme Court.
As part of this story, Joyce, you've been in contact with some of the families who may be affected, families of the victims of these juveniles, so the people who committed the acts while juveniles?
That's right. I talked to a couple of people whose loved ones were killed, and they expressed, I think, kind of a predictable sentiment that when these offenders were sentenced, it was like, never will they get out. And so it just kind of threw them, as one of them said, threw them into a tailspin when this became a possibility that these offenders could be released.
Mm-hmm. One of those was you spoke with the sister of a young man who was brutally killed in Marion.
Yeah, Teresa Ellickson's brother Greg Wells was killed. He was delivering pizzas, was brutally killed, stabbed and beaten in an apparent robbery gone bad.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to some part of an interview you conducted with Teresa Ellickson about really this gruesome murder.
And he went down, and his body was convulsing and trying to shut down, I assume. And they thought he was making a lot of noise, so they continued to harm him by trying to get his body to quiet. They tried to break his neck, and when his body still wouldn't stop, they went and got a kitchen knife and slashed his throat.
And you also talked with the daughter whose mother was killed by a juvenile.
That's right. Laura Schimmick's mother was killed by a 14-year-old offender, Ruth Ann Veal. It's a case that got a lot of publicity. And Laura Schimmick told me how she felt when she first heard that this life in prison without parole might be changed.
When we first heard about it, we were terrified that Ruth Ann would get out immediately. And that didn't turn out to be the case. And so her sentence has been changed. She now is one of the few inmates whose sentences have been resentenced or have changed to life with the possibility of parole.
And she, like many of the other family members of victims, have real serious reservations about that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about any action, because I know it's been attempted in the legislature to get something through here to rewrite sentencing guidelines for juveniles.
They've just not been able to do that because of the conflicting interest. You know, you've got the victims and the prosecutors who make a very strong case that these were brutal slayings. And then you have people who want the state to comply in some way with these Supreme Court rulings. But there have been suggestions of 35, 45. They've just not been able to come to an agreement on that. I should mention here that Governor Branstad took action, and he commuted all of these life sentences to 60 years, which, you know, for advocates for sentencing reform, that to them is like that's not much different than a life sentence.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is really the Iowa legislators from both sides of the aisle need to find the answer to the question of what, short of a mandatory life sentence, would be the longest sentence you could give a juvenile who commits such a crime.
That's right. They need to present to what the prosecutors and others will argue is they need to present guidelines for the court.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Joyce Russell, thank you for revisiting this story from 2014, which is ongoing. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, at year's end, we're looking back over the top news stories here in Iowa, as covered by our reporters and correspondents. Back in October, Morning Edition host and reporter Clay Masters investigated construction that damaged effigy mounds, Native American burial sites in northeast Iowa shaped like bears and birds. Clay joins me now to revisit the 2014 effigy mounds story. Hello, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Remind us how this controversy got started.
Well, I first heard about it. There was some reporting going on earlier this year about this Effigy Mounds National Monument. It's up in northeast Iowa near the Mississippi River, a real beautiful place. I'd never been there until I went out to do the story. Basically, it's a Native American burial grounds, and it's a place where different mounds are in the shapes of different animals, and there are also burial grounds, mounds that are not shaped like anything, where there are ancestors of different Native American tribes that are buried there. So it's a very old national monument that's under the watch of the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm. And there was some construction there that took place that shouldn't have.
Yeah, $3 million worth of illegal construction projects, and it went on for about a decade. And this is, as I said, it's one of the nation's most sacred Native American burial grounds. So a lot of people, not only in Northeast Iowa that live near the monument, but a lot of people around the country, very frustrated and angry with what happened up there.
Well, let's listen to the beginning of your report going back to October when you did take a visit to Effigy Mounds National Monument.
I'm surrounded by bluffs up here at Effigy Mounds National Monument in Northeast Iowa. I'm walking across a bridge over the Yellow River. Yellow and red leaves are falling from the trees. I'm less than a mile from the Mississippi River. And this bridge is pretty big. You could definitely drive an all-terrain vehicle across the thing. And it's made of some pretty solid stuff. Here, let me knock on this. Take a listen.
I will not rest the rest of my days until all this junk is removed.
That's Tim Mason. He used to work here among these ancient Native American mounds, some in the shape of bears, others look like birds. Ask Mason his title, and this is what you get.
Tree-hugging, dirt-worshipping hellraiser.
Okay, Clay Masters, you found a colorful individual. They're very dedicated to restoring this. So what's the next chapter of the story? Were people held accountable? What actually happened? There was construction without the proper process?
Yeah, the Park Service is quick to point out that nobody that was responsible for all this construction is employed with this park anymore. I took a visit to the top of the bluffs with the current superintendent of Effigy Mounds National Monument. And, you know, it's a very intricate trail, that bridge where you heard me knocking on the side of it. I mean, that's a enormous bridge that basically goes nowhere. And so all of this existing infrastructure is there. As Jim Nebsted pointed out to me, he said, let's involve the tribal partners, let's involve the State Historic Preservation Office, and make sure that there's a voice before he goes in and rips everything out, seeing that that would be, in his words, you know, just as bad as what originally took place there.
Mm-hmm. And I understand some of this construction took place with an eye towards making it more accessible, also to the handicapped, for instance.
Right, that was the intention. And there was so much that I just didn't even have time to put into this story. You know, you're limited in how much time you have. There were other issues. In one instance, a former employee tried to, quote-unquote, repatriate some old Native American bones by actually opening up one of the mounds. There was also a former employee there who was concerned about a new federal law that required museums to return ancient remains to tribes. So he took some of the bones back to his garage and, you know, later returned them. So there was investigations on that. So there's just all kinds of issues that have been happening up there in the last decade.
So this is still ongoing. What do you see as the fix eventually here?
Well, that's the difficult part. I mean, this trail is still there. There are all these issues. There's still some animosity among people in the town. And I took a trip on my way back from Northeast Iowa to the Sac and Fox tribe in Tama and talked with Jonathan Buffalo, who's the historic preservation director there. And I simply asked him, you know, what do we need to do? I mean, what does the Park Service need to do to undo this wrong? And he had kind of a philosophical answer in saying that, well, it depends on what are you trying to preserve. And he made an interesting kind of analogy to what's been happening in Detroit. So I want to hear what he had to say here.
It would be just like if Detroit decays anymore, it's going to look like ruins. So when you go to Detroit, that's going to be the Detroit you see. Empty buildings, empty houses, overgrown lawns. And that's going to be Detroit. You know, you weren't there when it was a automobile boom, you know. So which is the real Detroit, you know?
So as you have all of these collaborators trying to figure out what's next, nobody really seems to have the answer. And what's really interesting is that you have the National Park Service, which ultimately their job is to preserve artifacts, and they're trying to figure out how to undo its own construction that many in the area are viewing as a desecration of the land. So, you know, there is no one clear answer as to what's going to happen next.
Okay, Clay Masters talking about the controversy surrounding one of the most picturesque areas of Iowa, the National Monument, which is Effigy Mounds National Monument in northeast Iowa. Clay Masters, thank you for revisiting the story with us.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Good talking with you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, catching up on some of the most notable, some of our favorite news stories from 2014, as covered by some of my colleagues here at Iowa Public Radio in news. And I'm joined now by Iowa Public Radio's All Things Considered host, Pat Blank. Hi, Pat.
Hey, Ben.
We're going to take us back to a moment in the year when you got some turtle fever and let us know a lot of things, many things I didn't know about our native Iowa turtle population. What prompted you to do that?
Well, you know, it sounded like a really good idea at the time, because a group of students and their professor are doing some research that hasn't been done anywhere else in the state on a wood turtle. I had never heard of a wood turtle. I did a little research, understood that this was very rare for them to be able to do this. In fact, the professor worked on this for several years before he actually found a wood turtle. In fact, he found a shell, which led him to do more research, and he actually found the live ones then.
Mm. Okay, and I think we have a little bit of audio to remind our listeners of your piece on this. You're actually sloshing through the habitat of this wood turtle, and let's listen. This is Jeff Tamplin, a biology professor at the University of Northern Iowa you're with.
We tend to give them names that allow us to remember them more quickly, and it depends on who finds them. For example, most recently we use characters from Game of Thrones. So if it's a grizzled old male, we would give it the name of a grizzled old male. Or if it's somebody that's, say, missing their right hand, we'd give it a character whose right hand was chopped off in the book and the show.
Pat, I hear all the sloshing around. I can picture it there. I think I even feel like I've been bitten by a mosquito listening to that.
That's very typical. In fact, I got an email from Professor Tamplin before we went out there, and he said, make sure you have long sleeves. Wear some clothes that you will never want to wear again. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this sounded like such a good idea at the time. And everything was covered. We had masks for our faces. We had long sleeves. We had wading boots. And it was quite the trip indeed. And I am probably 40 years older than most of the people I was with at the time. And they're like, just climb over this log. And, you know, so I did my best. I was pretty proud of myself. But I have to tell you, it sounded like a better idea at the time than it actually turned out to be, at least trying to keep up with tracking the turtles with these students.
So you're on this turtle finding expedition. And this is really quite an undertaking. He and, four University of Northern Iowa students have found over 100 of these endangered species along Iowa waterways?
Yes, over the years. They've given them all names, as he said, rather than just a boring, you know, Iowa 87. You know, we found Broomhilda that day.
Yes, Broomhilda was found. It's amazing to think that 14 kinds of turtles in Iowa, something like that?
Right, right. And I had no idea. I had no idea that we had endangered ones near to us. And while we went out to this area and we had the UNI van, it was in a secluded area, and I was not really allowed. In fact, he asked me to be secretive about the area because of a story that actually surfaced recently where 16 turtles that were confiscated in an airport in Alaska are coming here to Dubuque to be at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, because there's quite a trade going on, illegally exported to China. Many of these turtles are. Mm. I had no idea.
Do we know if they're also turtles from Iowa, or this is just being used as a refuge?
It's being used as a refuge. These were actually confiscated at an airport in Alaska. They don't know exactly where they came from. But my point of all of this was, he wanted to make sure that I kept the location of these turtles secret, because some of those wood turtles were part of this group of turtles that were confiscated in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. So the point of this expedition of Professor Tamplin's work is what?
To study this type of species, their environment. What they also do is It helps if a group wants to do some relocation of, say, utility lines or water lines, or they want to do some work in that area and maybe build some houses and that kind of thing. He will tell them, he and the students, when is the best time to do that without disrupting their environment and or destroying them. So that's part of what they do for their research. There are times that the turtles are more in the water, and then it would be okay to relocate those utility lines, and or are they on the land? So that's part of it, yeah. And they share this. They got a research grant, and they're sharing it with several other states as well. It was a multi-million-dollar research grant from the U.S. Wildlife and Fisheries Division. It was a $494,000 award divided from UNI, and similar projects in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan.
Pat, before you go, I have to share with you my little turtle story, because a few years ago, I guess I was out walking with my family. I'm not sure if it was McBride State Park or Palisades Kepler State Park. Came upon a wonderful turtle. Found out later it was an ornate box turtle, one of these beautifully colored shells, a hefty size turtle. And we actually took it home, and then I was, after that, pangs of guilt. I thought, should we have done that? We fed it crickets for a while. It loved live crickets. And then we took it back to the park and put it back at the park. But prompts me with the question, you know, do you know if you're walking out in a park, should you touch the turtles? I wouldn't imagine you would do or should do what we did, which was take it home.
Shouldn't take it home, but everybody does. I mean, in fact, one of the biology students talked about that. You know, I said, this is how you grow up. This is how you learn about, you know, different species. He said this, and people have done this all the time. Not a good idea to take it home. Pick it up, look at it, turn it loose, leave it in its environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they are really beautiful creatures. And
absolutely.
It was beautiful and so unique to find out on a walk in Iowa. And Pat, thanks for joining us and telling us many things I didn't, and I'm sure many others didn't know about our native Iowa turtle population.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you've just joined us, it's a special year's end edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're chatting with Iowa Public Radio's reporters and correspondents about some of their top news stories in the state this year. Gambling and casinos have been part of Iowa's news landscape in 2014, and at year's end, Cedar Rapids is making a major legislative push, hoping to change Iowa's gambling laws. When we come back, I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg about that. Then Amy Mayer will be along to talk about the latest farm bill, which was signed in February of this year. Ooh, and it was a long time coming after nearly 2 years of negotiation. Amy Mayer, who covers the Ag Beat for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, will be talking about that. Also, over the past couple of years, tech giants like Google, Facebook, and Microsoft have announced that they'll build data centers in Iowa. Some of those data centers came into being in 2014. I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden about that. And we'll finish up with John Pemble and how Iowa commemorated the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. Also, if you'd like to chip in some news stories you didn't hear this hour, please go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and tell us about some news in Iowa that you'd like people to remember. It's a look back at some of the biggest Iowa news stories through the eyes of Iowa Public Radio's reporters and correspondents. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. We'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, if you've been tuned in, we're chatting with Iowa Public Radio's reporters and correspondents about some of the top Iowa news stories of this year. Gambling and casinos have been part of Iowa's news landscape in 2014. And at year's end, Cedar Rapids is making a major legislative push, hoping to change Iowa's gambling laws. And Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg is here to tell us about this, talk about it in some context this hour. Dean, hello.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us about this proposal from Mayor Corbett of Cedar Rapids.
Well, you know, it's been going on for a couple of years at least, Cedar Rapids trying to locate a casino in the downtown area as part of their comeback from the 2008 devastating floods in that downtown area. They got a big disappointment, and the Racing and Gaming Commission last April said no. Establishing a casino there would take too much business away from casinos already in Riverside, south of Iowa City, Dubuque and Waterloo, and the Native American casino over at Tama.
So we have a new tact. What is the new proposal?
Well, Mayor Ron Corbett, formerly a legislator himself, in fact, he was a leader. He was Speaker of the Iowa House of Representatives, now Mayor of Cedar Rapids, so he knows how to craft legislation to be politically attractive. He's proposing a special license be established in Iowa for a smoke-free casinos. Bear in mind that all other Iowa casinos are now exempt from Iowa's non-smoking and public places law. And it establishes a 10-year moratorium on any more casinos. That appeals to current casino operators. I should say he's got the American Cancer Society behind him on the non-smoking casino. So there are two constituencies already. He's proposing to rewrite the law on distributing profits from casinos so that cities and counties without casinos nearby would get more of a share of those profits in the future. And he has Senator Wally Horn, a Cedar Rapids Democrat, introducing the legislation in the democratically controlled Senate. Mm-hmm. And a Republican, Dan Zumbaugh, sponsoring into the House, where the Republicans control. And he says Cedar Rapids Mayor Ron Corbett is optimistic that Governor Branstad may also support the idea.
One, he's in favor of non-smoking casinos. And then just recently, the governor did a comment about the distribution of the gaming revenues and said that there are some inequities that have built up over the years, created a have versus a have not type of situation in the state of Iowa. So two pieces of our proposal he's come out in favor of. We feel that he wants to work on this issue as we're getting the same feeling from legislators. So nobody's closed the door on us yet.
Mayor Ron Corbett of Cedar Rapids, have versus have not. What does he mean by that phrase?
Well, that means that those areas that have casinos, they have additional business coming in there, and nonprofits such as, oh, let's say the Red Cross, or in Washington County, the Washington Ambulance Service there, gets some share of the casino at Riverside. That's the same across all of Iowa. I know that up in North Iowa, for example, there's a casino in Northwood that gives scholarships to all high school seniors going on to college in counties around that casino. That's what we're talking about.
Okay. I also noticed part of this proposal is a 10-year moratorium on new casinos after this is... No, that's
give us ours and then no more because...
Shut out the competition.
That appeals to those areas that have casinos already.
Oh, I see. So he's trying to get everybody on board, put enough appealing little aspects in here. And I don't know, you've been around for decades covering this sort of thing. It's fun to watch. It'll be fun to watch. I guess we don't know how it will turn out, but that will be the fun in 2015 to see how it will.
I don't think we're going to see, though, the existing casino areas get on board with this. This is going to be a struggle.
It is. Dean, before we say goodbye, talk about Regents funding for the public universities.
Well,
that's been another big news item this year in 2014.
Well, another struggle. The Regents plan for distributing state funding among the three state universities, that was changed this year. And the plan was developed by a study commission headed by former Regents President David Miles, and the Regents adopted it. It rewards those universities who enroll more Iowa residents with a greater share of the state appropriation. Well, Iowa State's enrollment increasing dramatically, and they have about 60% Iowa residents there, UNI with 90% Iowans, comparing to the University of Iowa's 49% Iowans. And the UI has been supporting its budget with higher tuition from state and international students. Now the UI, under this new plan, stands to lose about $13 million in the coming year. And that would be redistributed to Iowa State and UNI, who have more Iowa residents.
And the UI is reacting by ramping up efforts to recruit in-state?
That's right. And that's also another aspect of this, because ramping up the efforts to increase the very limited pool of Iowa high school seniors eligible to go anywhere, and some of them are going out of state anyway. Well, what does that do to the private colleges in Iowa who are also...
The community college.
That's right. Mm. And Cornell College up at Mount Vernon. I know I I just recently talked to the president there. They have 13% Iowans at Cornell. They'd like to increase that, but this is not going to be easy.
Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Bork, thank you.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we prepare to say goodbye to 2014, we're revisiting some of the news landscape reported on by our Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents during the year. The latest farm bill was signed into law in February of this year, and it was a long time coming after nearly 2 years of negotiation. Amy Mayer covers the Ag Beat for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. She joins me now. Hi, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
Hard to think. This farm bill, the last one, expired in the fall of 2012. It took us 2 years to get to a new one. Remind us why it became so controversial.
Well, remember, that's 2 years after it expired. They'd already been working on it leading up to the expiration.
Right.
And the reason it was just so contentious was these deep, deep divides within the Republican Party, and then, of course, between the Republicans and Democrats. And so you had the contentious issue of how much to cut the nutritional support programs, mainly food stamps. It was a budgetary necessity to make some cuts, but there were deep debates about how much to cut. And then within the Republican Party, there was a unusual divide because although typically the Republicans from rural areas in particular are just categoric farm bill supporters, in this one, because there were so many budgetary concerns, there was a lot of debate about just where those cuts should be and how much support there ought to be out there in the overall number of the bill, the budgetary number of the bill.
Mm-hmm. One of the aspects that I found nice, the silver lining in this very long negotiation over this, is we really learned that there are these two main prongs of our farm bill and have been for how many years? We have farm policies and food policies married.
That's right. And this marriage really goes back to the 30s, to the original support programs, which saw the obvious link between the people who grow food and the people who eat it. But a lot of that is a lot less obvious now as farmers are so segregated from the population centers where most of the people live these days. And so what had been something that was government money to grow the food and to help the people buy and eat the food has become this multifaceted, gigantic law that has, as we're talking about, made a lot of people really concerned in a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked about the final version of the bill that eventually became the new farm bill, you set out in a piece to ask where the votes were and were not for the final vote, which became law.
Here's the vote. Here, Marsha Fudge was one of the ones who voted for it. And then,
Dan Looker is the business editor at Successful Farming magazine. He's looking at the roll call in the House on the final bill. Democrats tended to vote no because of food stamp cuts. Marsha Fudge of Cleveland is a notable urban exception. So did 63 Republicans for a different reason.
In the final vote on the farm bill in the House, I understand there wasn't a single vote from Kansas for the bill, and that's very, very unusual.
Looker says it's a reflection of Tea Party conservatives, the minority of House Republicans who played a big part in stalling progress on the farm bill.
Okay, so Amy, a little excerpt from your piece covering the farm bill controversy and the eventual new farm bill. So this is really interesting that a big ag state like Kansas wouldn't have a single vote for the new farm bill.
It is really interesting, and I think part of that is politics. I think they knew, those legislators knew, that the farm bill ultimately would pass. But there were a lot of surprises along the way. And in the summer of 2013, when the House actually defeated a farm bill, there were observers who had thought, oh, of course the farm bill will pass, and it didn't. So I guess it's a political gamble that different elected officials make. And for those in Kansas, that was a place where they really wanted to stake a claim. You know, interestingly, in these elections that we just had in November, Pat Robertson, a Republican senator from Kansas, faced stiff opposition. He did get reelected, but it was looking questionable right up there until the election day.
Mm-hmm. Given that it took years of negotiation to get a new farm bill, I guess this one lasts 5 years, probably better start negotiating right away, huh?
You know, it sort of feels that way.
Is the next one going to be sort of 2019? It starts. It started in 2014. I don't know when it kicked into action, but when will this farm bill end?
I believe 2014 to 2019 is the current one, mm-hmm. Yes.
And what does your ag crystal ball say about whether the next one will be as contentious as this one?
It says that will have a lot to do with how Congress looks and who's in the White House after the 2016 elections.
So, Amy, when all is said and done, how does this new farm bill affect operations on the farm?
Well, there's two major ways. Crop insurance has now become the primary safety net for farmers, and that's a little bit different than the way crop insurance was structured in the past. But crop insurance is something farmers get from a private insurance agent, even though there's some federal subsidies. There are also federal commodity programs in the farm bill, and those have changed from what they used to be. Farmers have had to pay close attention to their yields this year, as well as their historical numbers and also what's happened in their counties, because they will have to make a choice this winter about what program they want to enroll in, and then they have to stick with that decision for the length of the farm bill.
Okay, Amy Mayer. She covers agriculture for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Ben.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we're looking at some of the top Iowa news and trends from 2014 with my colleagues here at Iowa Public Radio. Over the past couple of years, tech giants like Google, Facebook, Microsoft, they've announced they'll build data centers here in our state. And some of the data centers came into being this year, 2014. Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden is following the story, and she joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
Tell us about these. Remind us, what are these vast data centers popping up in Iowa?
Data centers are like a hotel for information. It's where the internet lives. And currently, three big names in tech have or are building data centers in Iowa: Google, Microsoft, and Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And so those of us who have things in the cloud, as they say, which is pretty much everybody, photos, documents, emails, this is where they are warehoused.
Exactly. It's a hotel for data.
Mm-hmm. And you got to visit one recently. We want to hear some audio from that. Let's have a listen.
This is our new fabric switching network. So as you can kind of see, and as we walk through, what you are going to see is spaces for growth and space to grow as our users grow, as our products and services grow. But this basically is our evolution and the determining factor of always staying on and always on network and reducing our failure domains. So as we go through, you can see we can always add more and more and just grow as the business grows. We're kind of future-proofing our network.
So you're in these data centers, Sarah, this huge hum background noise that we're hearing here. What do you see? What's going on when you go in the door?
To me, it was a little bit spooky because it was sort of dark. But basically, you see hallway after hallway of servers. We saw one room full of servers, probably the size of a rather large high school gymnasium. And in one building alone, there was four rooms full of servers, and there's room to expand.
Mm, okay. And so we get to the question of why these tech giants, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, are choosing Iowa.
That's a really good question. Part of it is that Iowa has a lot of wind energy, and because of pressure from customers, tech companies want to seem green. It's good for their public image. Plus, these companies consume a massive amount of electricity, and Iowa has some of the lowest utility costs in the country. Plus, Iowa has very generous tax incentives.
Mm-hmm. Tax incentives, TIFs you talked about in your
mm-hmm.
piece.
For example, Facebook has a 20-year exemption on paying property taxes, and Iowa agreed to give Facebook $18 million in sales tax refunds. That carries through 2023.
I guess the question then is, how does the state of Iowa know that these will end up being good investments, all these generous tax incentives?
Well, good-paying jobs, and it brings business to Iowa. There's some dissent in that. A lot of people say, you know, these are static industries that don't really beget more business. They just kind of sit there and consume energy, and they don't really contribute or interact much with the local economy, since 100 jobs, 300 jobs throughout the state aren't that many jobs in the grand scheme of things. Other people say, hey, we're bringing good jobs, they're good paying, and we're putting Iowa on the map. So it's a good branding thing for the state as well.
Mm-hmm. Did your visit bear that out, that actually these are large facilities, but not very heavily populated with Iowa workers.
The Facebook facility currently employs, I think, about 75 workers. So I'm not an economist. I can't say whether that's a lot or a little, but it's not like, I mean, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of people.
When you're in these places. One of the other parts...
Relative to the size, not at all.
Hmm. One of the other aspects you brought out here is, you know, the why Iowa question for these big data centers. We're relatively free of natural disasters, aren't we?
That's right. In fact, these buildings are built to withstand an F4 or an F5 tornado, so that's taken care of. Flooding can be planned for. We don't have to worry about incredibly humid weather in comparison to some states further south. There aren't earthquakes or tsunamis. So Iowa, because it's a fairly stable region geographically, is a good place to build a data center when it's funneling information all over the world. You know that your data will be at the ready. Chances are the system won't shut down if you compare to other places throughout the country.
Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and in this edition of our program, we're reminding ourselves of some of the top news stories covered by Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. This year, arts reporter John Pamble found an unusual beat, the Civil War. Over the course of 3 months, John followed a staging of Lincoln's last days at the state capitol, the return of Senator James Harlan's statue, and an exhibit depicting African Americans' role in the Civil War. John Pemble joins me now for a few minutes. Hello, John.
Hello, Ben.
It was the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's end, and so this was a good time to look at the facets that you did and see how Iowans commemorated that time in American history.
And the funny thing is, I didn't intend to do stories about the Civil War. It just happened that I did three stories in a row about this era of history, and the first one I did was a play about the life of President Abraham Lincoln. And it's not even about an event that really happened, but what it might have been like to watch an interview by a newspaper reporter with the president and his wife. This director and writer, a newcomer to Iowa, was actually able to stage this house in the Iowa House of Representatives for a one-day show. It's the first time that's ever happened, and it was quite a setting.
Mm-hmm. And also coincided when the statue of U.S. Senator James Harlan was permanently relocated in Iowa. It had been in a statuary hall in Washington, D.C. for 100 years. And you were sent there to cover the unveiling of Harlan's statue, not at the town, in the town of Harlan in, what is that, southwest Iowa, which is named for him, but in Mount Pleasant. Why?
Harlan's career really started to take off when he moved to Iowa, became a lawyer, and was appointed as president of what is now called Iowa Wesleyan College in 1853. He had that role for 2 years, but in that time he changed the name of the college, and he is held in very high regard to this day by that college.
Harlan had close ties with President Lincoln and his family, I understand. Is this something represented on the campus?
Oh, very much so. In 1868, James Harlan's daughter married Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd. They had grandchildren, and while the president never lived to see them, the grandchildren of Abraham Lincoln and James Harlan often came to Mount Pleasant.
John, I'm wondering why the statue was moved to Mount Pleasant instead of, for instance, the state capitol.
Well, Harlan loved Mount Pleasant. He loved Iowa Wesleyan College. He was on the board of trustees for 43 years. He taught classes. He was frequently on campus when he wasn't working in Washington, D.C.
And, John, with the sesquicentennial of the Civil War's end, there are lectures, exhibitions around the country commemorating this part of American history. And that brings us to your third Civil War story, in an Iowa art museum.
Yeah, the early years of photography happened during the Civil War, and it's the first time art represented a war in a very non-abstract way. There are pictures of war from this time, and while some were staged, the gritty reality of this brutal conflict is very present. There are collectors of prints made in the 1860s, and some of these prints sell for thousands of dollars. Judy Gnarl has lived in former Confederate states. She now lives in Virginia and in Washington, D.C. She began collecting Civil War prints just a few years ago. She's now 79. Her parents were both members of Congress. She's a semi-retired lawyer and lobbyist. And she says for most of her life, she avoided thinking about the Civil War because it forces her to deal with the struggle between her love for her southern home states and her contempt for the history of slavery in the South during the 19th century and the segregation that was so prevalent in the 20th century. So Judy Gnarl's been traveling around to photo shows, buying these prints. And as she goes, they are curated into an ongoing collection called Shadows of History, which is now at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art through January. She's very interested in finding prints of African Americans serving as Union soldiers because such images are rare. And it helps her reconcile her homeland's role in history and to be an advocate in the 21st century as this country continues to struggle with things like race and class.
Arts reporter John Pemble, thank you for looking back over some fine reporting you did. Three perspectives to mark the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. John, thanks, and we wish you much great arts reporting for the coming 2015.
Well, thanks, man.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.